today on Juneteenth, I'm very excited to be with city leaders who together are making sure that Los Angeles leads, not just in saving lives in response to a virus, not just in saving livelihoods in response to economic devastation, but to look at what we know, that racism is also a public health crisis in America.
Mayor Eric Garcetti this morning, as he signed an executive order implementing new racial equity initiatives in LA city government. Garcetti did this on Juneteenth. On this day, 155 years ago, June 19th, 1865, slaves in Texas finally learned they were free. It's been called America's second Independence Day. Even more significant now as the nation is grappling with systemic racism. This year, the holiday comes the day before President Trump holds what's being billed as his comeback rally in Tulsa. And it'll happen just blocks away from the site of one of the worst racial massacres in our nation's history, where white mobs burned down a thriving black community, killing some 300 people in 1921. We're going to talk about Juneteenth, Tulsa, and this present moment in America with two guests. James Goodwin is a lifelong Tulsa resident and the publisher of the city's black-owned weekly newspaper, The Oklahoma Eagle. And Dinah Ramey Berry is a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin. Her latest book is called A Black Women's History of the United States. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you.
And Dinah, let's begin with you. For the uninitiated, can you describe exactly what Juneteenth is?
Yes. So most people talk about emancipation when they're looking at the emancipation of slavery as something that occurred first with the Emancipation Proclamation that President Lincoln issued on January 1st of 1863. However, that was issued for states that were in rebellion, which were the 11 states that seceded from the Union. So essentially very few, if any, African-Americans received their freedom after 1863. After the Civil War ended on April 9th of 1865, essentially slavery was over, and there was also the ratification of the 13th Amendment. But in Texas, enslaved people were not informed of their freedom, and many of them probably heard of the Emancipation Proclamation, but their lives had gone about the same way it had prior to 1863, and even after the war started. They were working from sunup to sundown on cotton plantations, on sugar plantations, and it wasn't until a Union General, Gordon Granger, read another proclamation on June 19th of 1865 that many people learned that they were free.
And then what did they do when they learned they were free?
So it's interesting. I always like to think about the moment they found out they were free. So on that day, some people were present at the reading of this proclamation. Others, it trickled out because Texas, as you know, is a very large state. So there were rural areas that people were enslaved on, large plantations, small farms. And some of them were told by a relative of theirs because news traveled to them. Some of them were told because Union Army officers came throughout the state and were telling people that they were free. Others were told by their former enslavers that, okay, you're free now. Many African Americans initially, obviously it was a day of celebration. It was a day of jubilee. They were extremely excited because this was something that they had thought about probably almost every waking moment of their lives. But a number of them picked up their bags and left, literally left the plantation that same day. Others waited a few days to get themselves together, figure out where they were going to go, wanted to connect with other relatives. But for the most part, once African Americans found out they were free, they wanted to solidify their marriages, to get an education. They wanted to move and have a job and work land for themselves. And so these were just some of the things that, Black people did once they learned that they were free. And it wasn't until about a year later in 1866 that they started celebrating Juneteenth as a way to remember and recognize the freedom that they received a year before then.
And James, do you celebrate Juneteenth?
Yes, we do. We do here in Tulsa, have for since its inception, at least as long as I've been around.
How do you celebrate it?
Well, we generally, it's festive, music, food. There are presentations made by various speakers, that kind of thing, and people gather together generally to celebrate on an open field sometimes. In fact, there will be several venues here in Tulsa where activities will be going on. And probably three or four different venues generally around either speaking or live entertainment of some sort.
Mm-hmm. And so originally President Trump was going to hold this rally, a campaign rally today there. And what was the reaction to that in Tulsa?
Well, of course, it certainly had a chilling effect. Many people were not happy with that decision. And I suppose the conventional wisdom of those who were not particularly fond of the president was that he was going to use this moment as a photo op, as he did with the Episcopal Church in Washington, D.C. I mean, he's a master at getting publicity. But by the same token, he perhaps intended or not, he is focusing on a period reminding people that we as African Americans were held for centuries in bondage. And this freedom from bondage is what we are celebrating. From my point of view as a newspaper publisher, he's free, of course, to do what he wants to do. And as far as being insensitive, in a strange way, it may be unintended. My hope and prayer here for him is, although he is coming against the state health department's wishes and the local health department wishes, I just hope and pray that those people 2 weeks after he leaves, wherever they might be, because they've gathered 19,000 plus strong, that they don't utter the same praise that George Floyd uttered, and that is, I can't breathe. It would be kind of a poetic justice. I pray that didn't happen. But it really, the health hazard he presents, literally presents, is unfortunate.
Right. So you're talking about the problems with the coronavirus. Apparently, people are already lining up to go to this rally tomorrow.
They are. And they are. What I've seen, I've not seen anybody wearing a mask either, which makes it even more so. And, of course, it's really causing great consternation among the hospitals in the area and, of course, the health department officials.
Dinah, as someone who studies history and racial history, how do you view this moment with Trump holding a campaign rally in Tulsa?
I think it's unfortunate that he chose this date and this location, because when we look at the historic massacre that occurred at the end of May and early June of 1921, and we know that the coronavirus has had a disproportionate impact on African Americans in particular. And we also recognize that today is a holiday to celebrate emancipation and also to reflect on African American freedom. It seems like the idea of even having a campaign rally in this place at this time is offensive and poorly selected location.
Yeah, so that's two things. It's Juneteenth and the Tulsa massacre. We talked about Juneteenth a little bit. The Tulsa race massacre, not a lot of people know about it nationally or in Tulsa, for that matter, or Oklahoma. Or they didn't until very recently. I don't believe it was part of the curriculum, right, James, until this year.
Well, yes, that's correct. But we have been writing about it since the aftermath. The Oklahoma Eagle will be celebrating its 100th year here next year as well, contemporaneously with the massacre. And let me just say this about the massacre. Here is the thing that's interesting about Tulsa and the spotlight being put on Tulsa this time from my point of view. Even though people are fearful of and do not like the fact that he's coming, it does put a spotlight on the Black Wall Street that was destroyed. But what needs to be understood is Greenwood back in 1921 was quintessentially an American community. And it was built in spite of Jim Crow. Or better yet, it was built because of Jim Crow. Segregation was the way at the time. But what's interesting about Greenwood was Black Oklahomans, after the Indian Allotment Act, owned as much as 3 million acres of land in northeastern Oklahoma. And with that land, this is an oil and gas state. And with that land came prosperity. And when Jim Crow would not permit blacks and whites to trade with one another, they traded within themselves. And so even though Jim Crow was designed to subjugate African Americans, they prospered because they had the wherewithal to do so. And that's the thing that's remarkable. And when the massacre came, they rebuilt it. And I was the benefactor of the second rebuilding, grew up upper middle class. But it was destroyed. The fact that we prospered so in 21 proved racial superiority to be a big white lie. Because the feeling was that black folks were inferior. But given the opportunity, even though it was circumscribed, given the opportunity, this community proved itself to be people of faith, a forgiving people, a people who believed in hard work and industry, believed in education, and prospered as a result of it. I just think that his coming, even though it was not welcomed, those people who know truly the history of Tulsa, this is a testament that black folks were as capable as any other culture that was able to, in adverse circumstances, prosper, contrary to the racist beliefs of people who couldn't stand the fact that they were successful and tore it down out of sheer hatred and jealousy. But it rebuilt itself and contributed to the culture of America. Count Basie attributes getting his sound from the streets of Greenwood, having been here to play at the Dreamland Theater in the late 30s, and he heard this music. And there's a whole myriad of stories. There's so much history yet to be told about Black Oaklands.
And Dinah, as a historian, as someone who tells this history, in a kind of strange way, maybe President Trump has done the nation a favor in the sense that everybody's talking about Tulsa and this history lesson.
So I don't know if I'll go as far as saying he's done a favor, but I will say, just like the other guests, that I'm very happy that it has drawn attention to Black resilience. It's drawn attention to the ways in which African Americans have shaped our nation's history. And it also shows, when you look at if Juneteenth brought us to Tulsa this year, hopefully we'll get a history lesson while we're in Tulsa, and people will learn just all the wonderful things that the previous guest has just shared. And that there was not only resilience after Tulsa in 1921, some of the relics of slavery, like schools named after Confederate generals, were changed. I mean, this is after 21. So you see the activism of this community. There is a church that survived the massacre. The Vernon AME Church is one of the only surviving buildings, if I'm not mistaken. They're working on a memorial garden there. There are African-American and multiracial organizations in Tulsa demanding a just Tulsa, trying to focus on descendants and Black freedmen communities. So I think that if anything, as we celebrate Juneteenth today, we can think about and honor those in Tulsa and those that survived the massacre and those that rebuilt that community as a way to understand some of the origins of why Juneteenth is even celebrated. You celebrate emancipation, and emancipation reminds you of a very painful moment in American history, but you also celebrate the joy of being liberated from that moment. And at these festivals that people are going to be having today, there'll be speeches, as the guest mentioned, there'll be speeches. And at these speeches, oftentimes over the years, from the initial years of the celebrations from the 1866 forward, often elders who had experienced slavery would give speeches and give oral history and oral testimonies about what life was like during slavery so that younger generations would not forget. So I think here we are, 2020, June 19th, 2020, and we're talking about the institution of slavery, we're talking about African-American freedom, and we're also reflecting on the strength of the Greenwood District and how African-Americans rebuilt that community here in Tulsa.
Mm. I love that. I love that you're ending on a positive note. And on another positive note, do you think that Juneteenth should be a national holiday?
Absolutely, 100%.
Okay. Well, happy Juneteenth to both of you. Dinah Ramey Berry is a historian at the University of Texas at Austin, and James Goodwin, publisher of the Oklahoma Eagle. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Coming up, LA Congresswoman Karen Bass on national police reform legislation that will be taken up next week in Washington. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Next week, the House and Senate will meet to consider competing police reform bills. Both sides agree there needs to be more police training, that body cameras should be mandated, that lynching should be a federal crime. But the House version goes further than the Senate plan. It would ban chokeholds nationwide, and it would make it harder for police officers to win civil suits based on qualified immunity, among other things. Joining us now is LA Congresswoman Karen Bass. Welcome back to Press Play.
Thank you.
Well, before we get into that, the policing reform and the competing bills, I want to ask you about Juneteenth. Today is Juneteenth, after all. And yesterday, Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn said he would push to make the day a national holiday.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Does that surprise you? Oh,
yes,
sounds
it does,
like you're surprised.
I'm very glad to hear that. That's good news. Good. I know that there is a bill over in the Senate for that and a bill in the House.
So what does that say to you about where Republicans are now?
Well, it says to me that this senator said that he supported it, and I think that's great. Now, I would love to see it followed up with the understanding of the relationship between justice and policing and the African-American community historically.
So it sounds like you're a critic of the bill. The Senate bill?
Well, first of all, there's two Senate bills. There's Tim Scott's bill, which actually mimics a lot of our bill, but it takes out the enforcement, it takes out the teeth. Then there is Senator Harris and Senator Booker. We drafted our bills together. So I would like to see Scott's bill be stronger, and I would like to see Harris-Booker bill have a hearing and a vote in committee.
What is the main area of disagreement between the two bills?
Well, take a couple of issues. First of all, in Scott's bill, qualified immunity is not there. In Scott's bill, with the no-knock warrant that killed, that was the reason that Breonna Taylor died in her sleep, shot 12 times, the suspect they were looking for was already in police custody. We ban no-knock warrants for drug warrants. In Scott's bill, they say they want to gather data about it. We ban chokeholds. In Scott's bill, they want to study it. So that's an example of the enforcement, the teeth being not in Scott's bill, and hoping that Scott and the other senators will recognize that the protesters that are out there are really asking for significant change. And if we did symbolic change, if we did smoke and mirrors, I think that would really enrage thousands of people.
Are you worried, though, that if both sides, the House and the Senate, don't budge on their respective bills, that nothing at all will come out of this? It'll be kind of like immigration reform or health care reform.
That is possible. But I am hoping that, because this is different. And I think it's different because of the public outcry. It's different because of 70% of Americans say they want to see substantive change. And it's not a good idea for Congress to ignore 70% of the American people.
In the House, how many Republicans are on board with your legislation?
Well, the bill that passed so far is a Democratic bill. However, I will tell you that I have a list of Republicans I'm talking to over the next few days who expressed interest during the hearing of being a part and participating. So we'll see if we get there. I'm not surprised that the Republicans did not come on immediately, because we responded very quickly. And we think that was the appropriate thing to do, considering what was happening in the country. This is not an issue that a lot of my Republican colleagues were even familiar with. They were not aware of the history of policing in relation to the African-American community.
Have you spoken with Kevin McCarthy?
Yes.
And,
yes.
And where
Kevin
is he?
And I were, McCarthy and I were in the State House together, so we have a relationship and speak frequently and believe that we can get there. So we'll see.
So you see some movement on his part?
Well, I see the openness, and I know that our various staffs have met. So I do think it's possible. Again, I mean, this bill was introduced just 2 weeks ago, so we are in very early stages. But we moved it quickly because that's the appropriate thing to do, considering what is happening in the country, and we will see if we're able to come to some level of consensus. Of course, I'm concerned. I don't want it to go there and in the Senate and be on a big stack of bills, a couple hundred if I'm not mistaken, that are bipartisan that have not been acted on in the House. I mean, in the Senate.
Right. Well, speaking of moving quickly, this idea of defunding the police has really taken hold nationwide, here in Los Angeles especially. Mayor Garcetti has actually pledged to cut more than $100 million from the police budget. Do you support this idea of defunding the police?
I think what the mayor did is exactly the point. He did not defund the police. He changed the police budget to invest in solving some of the problems that the police complain about all the time, and I agree with. We have, because we have cut funding to the safety net programs, we've divested from our cities, and the corresponding problems then are left to the police to clean up, and police complain about it all the time. They're not social workers. Why should they have to deal with people who are mentally ill? That's a medical problem. You know, in the Los Angeles area, we have Twin Towers. Twin Towers is the nation's most expensive mental health institution. What we have done over the last 3 to 4 decades is, instead of solving social problems, we have invested in police and incarceration. And that is, to me, a horrible way to address problems in communities and in society.
What should be done? You mentioned Twin Towers. What should be done given the fact that so many inmates right now are testing positive for COVID?
We need to release a lot of people. So, for example, there shouldn't be anybody in our jails that are there just because they couldn't make bail. I understand if you need to keep somebody in jail because you have absolute reason to believe that they are a danger and they're going to commit violence. But you and I know that a large percent of people who are in our county jails are there because they can't make bail or they're awaiting their court date. I think that there should be 100% testing in jails and prisons, and that means testing of staff and inmates. Some of our prisons were testing the inmates, which I think is good, and not testing the staff, not letting the inmates have visits. So who do you think is going to bring in the virus? When people do test positive, they need to be quarantined and they need to be treated.
Are you on board with all the reopening that's happening here in LA County?
Well, I think LA and California has been exemplary in how we have gone about managing the virus. Now, we still have a lot of issues. There's still a disproportionate infection and death rate. We need to address that. But I think that our reopening is in a measured fashion, and that is exactly what should happen. My concern is the administration is not admitting that they have adopted a herd immunity policy, which just means forget all the public health stuff. Let's just get this virus over with. Those that get infected. Those that die, die. And then we'll all have immunity. And the president has literally said this. I mean, he has said, well, you know, the people that are dying because they're older or they have other health conditions. 118,000 Americans have died in the last 3 months. The population of the United States is over 300 million. The population of India is 1.3 billion. India has lost 12,000 people. So what has happened in this country has really been because of failed leadership at the top.
I'm wondering, though, here in Los Angeles today, nail salons, bars, tattoo parlors are reopening. It seems like here in LA, it's the same kind of idea that we're just going to go out and try to resume our daily lives, albeit with masks on, hopefully, and social distancing, hopefully. But, you know, one of the signals from our leaders, the overwhelming signal, it seems to be, is that we need to reopen for the economy's sake. And one of the reasons is there's not a lot of federal help coming to people who desperately need it. Unemployment is going to run out pretty soon. And there's, you know, there's no more PPP program. So,
well,
what is the role of the federal government in trying to help states maintain these policies while still not foregoing the economic problems?
Well, first of all, I'm not convinced that we're not going to do anything. I mean, out of the House, we passed the HEROES Act. The HEROES Act is in the Senate. That would extend unemployment. That would issue, you know, additional checks to people. And so I'm not willing to concede that. What typically happens in Congress is that we wait until the last minute. When people are on the verge of running out of unemployment, then all of a sudden we'll have, you know, an emergency meeting and pass it. I think that's horrible. I think it's horrible to put that stress on folks, but you know that is typically the way things happen. So I do think there'll be support coming. One thing I know about our city and the leadership we have in our city and in our state is that if reopening in the way we are is not helpful and there's another spike, we'll go back again. We have been very aggressive. We were one of the most aggressive states in the beginning of the virus, and I have the confidence in the leadership in the city and in the state and in the county that we will respond accordingly.
But cases in California are going up.
Well, they're going up in some places, and I believe we have and will respond accordingly. You know, I mean, that's what's happened in other countries, too. They've opened up, they've tested it, and then they've had to shut back down. And I think we'll probably be facing the same thing.
That we'll have to shut down again?
Well, that we'll have to respond according to how the virus is acting.
Mm-hmm.
I hope we don't, but we'll see.
Well, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's Congresswoman Karen Bass. She represents parts of West and South L.A. Up, why the tiny Northern California town of Fort Bragg may rename itself.
He's generally known as one of the worst generals of the Civil War. He was not a good guy. He had a bad temper, and he's just not a great person to be named after in general. But we were named after him when he was considered a hero in a different war.
That's coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We are not just reevaluating policing these days. Everything is now under scrutiny. Income inequality, healthcare discrimination, who's hired at media companies, how Black lives are portrayed on screen, why our food packaging has racist imagery. Mrs. Butterworth's? Really? And how we commemorate heroes. Confederate statues are coming down, as are Columbus and Junipero Serra monuments. And up in Northern California, in Mendocino, the small town of Fort Bragg is considering renaming itself. It was named after Braxton Bragg, who later became a Confederate general. We're going to talk about this now with Robin Epley. She's the editor of the Fort Bragg Advocate News and the Mendocino Beacon. Robin, welcome.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Tell us, who was Braxton Bragg, and why is your town of, what, 8,000 people named after him?
So Braxton Bragg was originally a military commander in the, I believe, Second Seminole War and the Mexican-American War, where he served with a man named Horatio Gibson. And Gibson later went on to found a military outpost a few hundred miles north of the Presidio in San Francisco that he called Camp Bragg. And Camp Bragg later became Fort Bragg. And that was about 10 years after the Mexican-American War. But this was previous to the Civil War. So Braxton Bragg had not yet become a Confederate general. Now, Fort Bragg ended, there was no military outpost here as of about 1867. But of course, in that time period, the Civil War happened and Braxton Bragg served as a Confederate general. He actually had a plantation in Louisiana. He owned about 105 slaves. And he's generally known as one of the worst generals of the Civil War. He was not a good guy. He had a bad temper, and he's just not a great person to be named after in general. But we were named after him when he was considered a hero in a different war. So,
that war is problematic in and of itself for other reasons, because
it
was part of the Manifest Destiny, and Mexico really lost a lot in that war, including California.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. There's a lot of things wrong with the name and the man.
All right. So you're named after it. You're for a paper that has his name in it. And so now people are wondering, should we be renamed? Should we rename ourselves there in Fort Bragg? What are people saying?
People are very split. Mendocino County is generally known as pretty liberal, but obviously there's also rural areas, and the town itself is small. Like you said, we're only about 8,000 people, and there's very vehement views on both sides. It'll be interesting to see when the city council has their meeting this Monday to see what people have to say.
So what are they saying so far? What are some of the pros and cons?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously some of the stuff that we've already just talked about, that it's, you know, he's not a great guy to be named after, that the legacy just isn't one that we want to be associated with. On the other side, people are very concerned with the amount of money that it would take to change the name. The city has come out and said that it could cost just the city as much as $271,000. And that's not counting the high school that would have to change its name, and the uniforms, and all of the shopkeepers here who have product that say Fort Bragg on it. They'd have to get rid of it. So really, it's kind of an incalculable number. But also, people have been here for a long time. You know, third, fourth, fifth generation families live here, and they're very attached to the name, and they don't associate it with a Confederate general.
Right. And it's also, I guess, a learning and teaching opportunity too, right? If people didn't understand why or didn't know who their town was named after, well, now they do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that for the most part, people probably knew who it was named after, but really didn't, like I said, didn't associate it with him. We're not a military outpost. There is no fort here. There is not like Fort Bragg, North Carolina, where there's actually military stationed there. There hasn't been military stationed here since about 1867. We're very typical tourist town in Northern California. People associate us with beautiful ocean views, not a Confederate general.
Has this ever come up before, this idea of renaming?
It has, absolutely. And it seems to be increasing in frequency as well. So from my own research, I was able to find instances in 2004 and 2015 and possibly also 2017 where this issue came up. But every time it's been shot down by the community. This time feels a little more urgent, a little different.
Right, because we're having this national conversation and shifting our perspectives remarkably in all sorts of areas, as I outlined earlier. And so do residents think like, okay, it might cost a lot of money, but it'll be worth it in the long run? Or is it basically the money that is holding people back from going ahead with this?
I think that's a big part of it. I don't think that's everyone's reasoning behind not wanting to do it, those who don't want to. Some people are just really attached to the name. Some people don't see the point in washing over the history, be it good or bad. Others are very offended by the name and are worried that it could affect the tourism industry, which our town so strongly depends on.
Any ideas of replacement names?
Yeah, so there are some calls to replace it with the original name for the area, the local Pomo tribe. We could call it Pomo Bluffs, somebody suggested, or Noyo was the name of the area before it was called Fort Bragg. There's a Noyo River here. I've heard somebody say we could sell the name and raise money for the change to maybe Drake or Kanye, which I think is kind of funny. But also there's been some interesting calls, right? There's been some interesting calls to name it for somebody else named Bragg. Most interestingly, there's a Union general named Edward Bragg, who served very honorably. It was, I believe, a U.S. senator or congressman, and he's from Wisconsin, so not that much different from being named after a guy from North Carolina. Or possibly,
same spelling?
I believe there's same spelling. And there's a, I think, a mathematics professor out of the Bay Area whose last name is also Bragg. And he is, I believe he's a black man. And some people were suggesting perhaps we name it after him.
Is he down with that?
I have no idea.
It'd be kind of nice to have your town a town named after you.
Yeah. I think it would be. Maybe they could call it, name it after me. We'll see.
Okay, the town of Fort Robin. Sold.
Sure, I like that. I don't think anybody else would, though.
Robin Epley, she's editor of the Fort Bragg Advocate News and the Mendocino Beacon. Robin, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, we will have your Friday film reviews. Don't go away. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, if you're thinking about renting a movie this weekend, we have some recommendations. Joining me to talk about what's new is Jacqueline Coley, editor for Rotten Tomatoes. Welcome back.
So glad to be back. Happy Juneteenth.
Thank you. You too. And so glad to have you back. And Sean Edwards, film critic for Fox TV in Kansas City and the co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association. Hi, Sean.
Hey, how's it going? Happy Juneteenth. I'm glad to announce that I've been celebrating this now for four decades.
Well, that's good. And it just gets us right into the first movie, which is called Miss Juneteenth. And this is the directorial debut for Channing Godfrey Peoples. And here's a clip from the trailer.
Welcome to the Miss Juneteenth pageant.
I will never get over seeing Miss Juneteenth cleaning toilets.
The winner of Miss Juneteenth will receive a full scholarship to any historically black institution of your choice.
She my dream now. I'm gonna make sure that she's something that we ain't.
All right, Jacqueline, we spoke with the director yesterday on the show and talked about the plot, basically about a former Miss Juneteenth whose life didn't go as she wanted it to and is now pinning all her dreams on her daughter. What did you think of it?
Well, as a Texas girl, I have to say what Channing Godfrey Peoples did with Miss Juneteenth is completely extraordinary. It is bathed in authenticity of the Juneteenth celebration and the pageant, which again gives scholarships to young African-American women if they want to attend a historically black college. It's led by an incredible performance by Nicole Bari and the newcomer Alexis. It's just, I think, a film that speaks to this idea of mothers looking for their daughters for legacy and improvement. There's a great line from the film that Nicole Bari says, "I'm not going to have her pay for or commit my same mistakes." And I think that is a sentiment that I think everybody who has a child strives to, that they will achieve higher heights than their parents did. But particularly with this one, as she was on the precipice of great heights and unfortunately became pregnant as a teenager and wasn't able to reach those, she's even more, I would say, impassioned in making sure that her slightly rebellious daughter finds a happy ending.
Where has Nicole Bari been all this time, Jacqueline?
I don't know. You know, after Sleepy Hollow, she's been doing a lot of independent films, but I have always thought of her as just this incredible actress. When this premiered at Sundance, so many folks remarked on, you know, she was in Shame, and she's had this career where you just are wondering why she hasn't broke through. So I would love to sit down with Nicole and ask her myself, but I hope this is the catalyst to bring her back to the consciousness, if you will. And I look forward to seeing much more from her in 2020 and beyond.
Sean, what did you think of the movie?
Absolutely, positively love this movie. This is just a fantastic feature film debut. And it's all because of the writing. I thought the strongest aspect of the film was the screenplay. Channing Godfrey Peoples just did a fantastic job. And as they teach you in film school, write what you know. And she knows this world, and you can tell by this film. I mean, she captures the essence of this city and these people and this community. And she throws in so many different topics effectively in the film. I mean, the movie, you know, you get a good sense of what Juneteenth is all about from the movie, but it also talks about black business ownership She touches on historically Black colleges and universities and their importance. The whole mother-daughter dynamic is fantastic. The relationship dynamic was terrific. And it's none of it is false, which is so amazing. And yes, I want to second that Nicole Beharie is criminally underrated. She's does a fantastic job in this movie, and there's this through line with her performance that goes back to the 1974 film Claudine, which was played by Diane Carroll in her Oscar-nominated performance. And there's a lot of similarities in these two performances. It's just amazing and brilliant and so well done on every level.
Wow, I didn't know about Claudine. Should we go back and watch that?
Without a doubt, it's my all-time favorite romantic movie starring Diane Carroll and James Earl Jones. And you'll get a sense of how these two films are sort of like similar and parallel, and that whole mother dynamic and dealing with the family and being blue collar and the struggle for the American dream.
Okay, moving on now to 7,500 or 7,500, whatever it is. It's stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and this is another directorial debut, this time for a German filmmaker named Patrick Vollrath. Here's a clip.
European 162, what's your emergency?
We have a 7500. Several men attacked our cockpit. We stopped them from now. The captain is injured. Status of the crew, I don't know.
They have a hostage. They're going to kill him if I don't open the door.
I'm sorry, but you know that under no circumstances you are allowed to let them to the cockpit.
Oh, boy. Okay, so this takes place entirely on an airplane. Is that right? Is it claustrophobic? Sean, what did you think?
It's very claustrophobic. It's also tragically, it felt slow for a 90-minute movie. Yeah, there have been better movies done like this, like United 93, which was directed by Paul Greengrass. It was awful formulaic. It just felt odd that the pacing didn't seem to work. And it's also seemed like the type of movie that either a Bruce Willis or Harrison Ford or Wesley Snipes would have made like 25 years ago, but it would have been a far better movie with way more action.
Or we could just watch Airplane, which is really fun. It takes place on an airplane.
A lot funnier, yes. a lot funnier. This movie, the tone is so deadly serious that it's almost boring.
Wow. For a thriller, boring. So basically, the plot is what, Jacqueline?
I mean, this is basically a pilot's going about his everyday. Obviously, the pilot's played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and he is succumbed by a terrorist attack. And so he has to make choices on the behalf of all the bodies that he has on his plane, but also the possibility that his plane could be used for destruction, very similar to what was probably going through the cockpits on several hijacked plane operators, like several pilots who've been on hijacked planes. I agree with Sean. I actually even more so felt that the only thing the film is really great at, besides the performances, which I do think that Joseph Gordon-Levitt really does an amazing job in this film, and he was very captivating to watch. The only thing it really is good at is putting this sense of dread, claustrophobia, and unease. And because it doesn't go anywhere else from there, throughout the plot, you're right, it feels very flat. And more importantly, and this is one of those moments where I do have to say that the film is going to be beholden to the time that we're in. As a woman that has been locked up in quarantine for 3 months, this is not the type of escapism that I am looking for. I want to see the crowds in Juneteenth so that I can remember what it was like to be around people without fear. This is not that movie for me. This is exactly the opposite. And I actually think it's actually the film that I felt that it was doing a poor service to was actually The Guilty, which was a film from, I think, 2018, and it was Danish. And it's another one of these films all in one room that has a sense of dread with one primary character. That film was done incredibly well. And I think that's what they were trying to go to with 7,500. But I think in an effort to make it bigger and brasher, they forgot the reason why those films work is because it's the central character and really just what's going on between their head. That's it.
Oh, yeah. Shout out for The Guilty. That was a great movie.
Well, I also want to say, because of everything that we're going through right now, I also felt that the villains were awfully stereotypical because they were all Islamic, but there was really no depth to them. They almost seemed cartoonish in nature. And I'm not sure that'll play well right now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Jacqueline, I think you got your wish in this next movie because it's all about being outside. It's called The Short History of the Long Road, a road trip story with a young girl and her father in an old camper van. They live in it and they drive around the Southwest. Here's a clip from the trailer.
What's your next stop?
Kind of just let the road tell me where to go.
It's some antique you got here. What the hell are you doing?
Working for you. You need the help, and I need the repairs.
Fear is the only thing holding these people back. You know, they've got their driveways, they've got their backyards, they've got their pools. We have our freedom.
Jacqueline, hashtag van life. Were you into it?
Yes, I'm so into van life. This is one of those movies. I actually caught this one on the festival circuit very early, and I'm so happy that it's getting a release because I am one of these people that fantasizes about my dream van that I would decorate. I'm very much into like tiny house. So this is the movie for you. And it's really led by a brilliant performance by Sabrina Carpenter, who is someone that folks may remember. She did Girl Meets World, but she is someone I think folks could definitely keep their eye on, a young actress. And in this film, you know, it's her and her father. They're on the road together. And at a certain point, she is forced to figure out if she's able to continue this journey on the road in the way that her father has led her to believe it should be. He is very much about this minimalist. You don't need to have a job. You just need to earn enough to get by. And so long as you are self-sufficient, you will always be free. And she is essentially combating that with what maybe she wants, which is companionship and friendship and the idea of being a part of something. And in, I think, some adverse situations where her band breaks down, she finds both what her choices will be and also, I think, honoring some of the things that her father sort of instilled in her. Also has a great performance by Steve Ogg. It also has a performance by Maggie Siff and Danny Trejo, doing some really great work in this one. I absolutely loved it, and I think folks should check it out, whether you're hashtag van life or not. I think it'll make you question just how many things you have in your house, a little bit.
Okay, Sean, what did you think? Are you doing some spring cleaning after watching this?
I'm not going to do any spring cleaning because I stay clean, but I did love this movie. I like this movie a lot. First of all, it's beautifully shot. The cinematography in this movie is like next level. Love that aspect of it. And I did love the lead, Sabrina Carpenter. I thought she was very strong. I like the way they structured the story. It's basically told in three parts. There's, you know, the story of her dad, the story of her mom, and then the story in between. However, I do sort of hate the fact how Hollywood sort of like over glorifies bad parents, which is basically what this young lady had, which led to her circumstances. But, you know, if the parents weren't horrible, you wouldn't have this beautiful movie. So I'm not mad at it. I mean, you know, it just demonstrates how, you know, she's raised off the grid. That's how she lives her life. And it basically works. And I did love Danny Trejo. I've never seen him better. I thought he was great in the movie. So it worked. It worked for me.
So by bad parenting, you're meaning because the dad takes her out on the road. She's not going to school. And then he basically dies on her.
Yeah, this type of parent's been featured often in a lot of different types of movies. And if the parent were a little better and gave a little different life advice, you know, because basically the film shows this young lady that, like, in typical situations, in real life, doesn't normally go so well. But it's a movie, and this one worked out okay. But often in real life, it doesn't.
Okay, finally, any films you recommend for people to watch this Juneteenth weekend? And we'll start with you, Sean.
I recommend you watch Miss Juneteenth. I mean, what better movie to watch today, tomorrow, or I mean, whenever? Just, it's the timing on this is just incredible.
Jacqueline?
I will agree with that one, but I also will say that it is a great time to kind of echo that. What Sean was mentioning, Claudine is an absolutely amazing film. And I think if you're going down maybe, I think, a classic film sort of binge, that is one that maybe get overlooked, but I absolutely think you should take some time to view that one. And I think you will have a great time with it.
All right. Well said, and happy Juneteenth to both of you. Thank you so much for coming on today. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Jacqueline Coley, editor for Rotten Tomatoes, Sean Edwards, film critic for Fox TV in Kansas City, and the co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association. Press Play's producers are Rosalie Atkinson, Brian Hardzinski, Angie Perrin, and Kaylee Wells. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Amy Ta is our digital producer. Mario Saavedra and Phil Richards are our technical directors. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you on Monday.